I think across the accounting profession, and with each of us putting in time or resources where we can come up with a strategy that probably might be better than something that actually world leaders, whether they're public or private sector by themselves, could do.
And we're back with episode 99 of Future Proof. Bill Sheridan's my name, and I bet you never thought we'd ever be coming back. Ever be coming back, did you? It's been a couple weeks since our last show. Rest assured, we haven't been just sitting around doing nothing. We've been in the middle of this crisis like everybody else. After all, lots of stuff to do, keeping folks up to date on all the latest developments. And by the latest, I mean down to the second. This COVID-19 stuff is changing in real time. It seems like as soon as we tell folks one thing, it changes into another, which makes our job just a bit challenging, but interesting too, to say the least. So yeah, we've been a little busy tracking all this COVID-19 related nonsense, but we're back this week. We got a great show for you. First, let me start by telling you this week's show is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses, dozens of instructors, and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. So here, do me a favor, will you? Please close your eyes for a minute. And think back a few months, all the way back to January. Can you do it? Can you even remember what January looks like at this point? It seems like 1,000 years ago, right? Does to me anyway. Everything that happened before this virus showed up seems like another age, doesn't it? January was only 4 months ago, people. This was still during that quaint little time when we talked about disruption as, I don't know, something we had time to prepare for, right? Advances in technology and future laws and regulations, and what will happen when all of the boomers are gone and the millennials take over for good. This was all the stuff we knew was going to happen and that we had to start preparing for now, but we still had a little bit of time, right? We did a lot of that here at Future Proof back in the BC era. I'm calling that before coronavirus. We talked a lot about future disruptions and transformation and anticipating what all that stuff would look like once it arrived. And so did my guest this week. He is David Bray. David is, where do I even begin with David? He served in a variety of leadership roles in turbulent environments, including, listen to this, bioterrorism preparedness and response from 2000 to 2005, time on the ground in Afghanistan in 2009, serving as the nonpartisan executive director for a bipartisan National Commission on Research and Development, providing leadership as a nonpartisan federal agency senior executive. And back in December, he accepted a leadership role to incubate a new global center with the Atlantic Council. So you might say he's just a little familiar with change and chaos, which makes him the perfect guest this week, right? And in January, the AICPA brought David in front of its executive roundtable in New York City to talk about disruption and digital transformation and technological advances. And that's how I actually got connected with him. Some folks who heard him speak in New York in January, they were amazed by what he had to say and thought he'd be a great guest for the show. And then came March and COVID-19. And suddenly, you know, future disruptions like the Internet of Things and blockchain and AI, they didn't have quite the same urgency as they once did. Because at that point, we were face-to-face with the biggest disruption of our lifetimes. And it wasn't theoretical. It was here. It was now. And it was having very real impacts on all of us. And our response had to be immediate. We've already seen a number of guesses as to how you know, accounting and finance will change as a result of this crisis. For starters, remote work is probably here to stay in one way or another. A lot of folks who were reluctant to embrace remote work before the crisis are now fans of it. They're saying it works. They're saying their people are more productive. They're seeing positive, possible savings when it comes to like the footprints of their offices. This is real stuff that probably won't ever go away. Next, all of those technological advances that we've been talking about for all these years, there's going to be a rush to master them. Okay, this is what consultant Jennifer Wilson says. She says, quote, those who previously relied on staff, administrators, or IT professionals for help with technology are having to go it alone at home. Remote work is causing everyone to up their technology game, making full use of the firm's various remote access, workflow, and file sharing solutions, end quote, right? This crisis is likely going to speed up also the adoption of advisory services, which CPA firms had already been pursuing pretty quickly before the crisis. And then there's audits. I'm hearing a lot about this recently. Here's how CPA Practice Advisor describes this issue. They write, quote, although digital advances continue to influence how audits are conducted and how evidence is gathered, as well as aspects of the reporting process, for many firms, the crisis is creating a systemic shock to normal client engagement activities, from increased pressure to complete audit work to issues in getting audit evidence and very sensitive judgments in areas such as going concern. Auditors will need to reevaluate how they undertake normal auditing activities. There are challenges ahead, but respondents also spoke openly about opportunities. First, the challenges. A significant 53% of respondents said they were experiencing pressures completing client services work, and over a third said they faced an inability to meet reporting deadlines, a point recognized in many jurisdictions where reporting deadlines have been flexed. A quarter of respondents said they're experiencing difficulties in gathering audit evidence, and 27% said they saw an increased audit risk related to valuation of assets, completeness of liabilities, or going concern issues. Now, on the positive side, respondents have already reported significant opportunities for providing enhanced insights and value to audited entities through the audit process, end quote. All of that as a result of what we're going through right now. So yeah, that phrase new normal gets thrown around quite a bit these days, doesn't it? But with good reason. This crisis is fundamentally changing many aspects of our profession. It's disruption in real time, as I said. And I guess the question is, how are we all going to deal with it? Which brings me right back to my guest this week, David Bray. The reason I wanted to speak to him initially was to discuss technological disruptions like the ones he discussed at the AICPA's executive roundtable in January. But all that changed with the coronavirus. So instead, we talked about how we work and do business and how all of that is changing because of this crisis and the roles accounting and finance professionals will play in all of that. And how this crisis has significantly accelerated the disruptions we'll feel as a result of new technologies like AI and the Internet of Things and 5G. It's a fascinating discussion, folks, with a really deep thinker about disruption. And it's one you'll probably want to sit down and listen to because, you know, quite frankly, we're all being disrupted as we speak. So good stuff this week. Here is my conversation with David Bray. So Dr. Bray, thanks for joining me today. This conversation kind of grew out of your appearance in January at the AICPA Executive Roundtable. A lot of folks there that I've heard from, including my boss, Tom Hood, they were raving about your message about the Internet of Things and its impact on the future of accounting, which I still want to ask you about briefly a little later on. But first, I wanted to kind of start with the obvious, right? I mean, I stumbled across your bio on the Singularity website, which says that you're an expert at, among other things, the concept of disruption, that you've served in a variety of leadership roles in turbulent environments. And personally, I can't recall a more disruptive or turbulent time than the one we're in right now. So I guess I'm curious whether you've thought at all about how we work and do business is changing, right? And like right before our very eyes as a result of this pandemic, how different are things going to look in a post-coronavirus world?
Yes. So first, thanks for having me, Bill. And I would say the short answer is they're going to look very different. Now, the longer extrapolation of that is that I think we need to recognize that while some may have felt like their COVID-19 response and the stay-at-home strategy was just sort of like a very long extended snow day or something like that. And I think what people are increasingly beginning to recognize is things have fundamentally changed. And it's not to say that we won't get back to some set of new normal, but we're not going to get back to the normal we had before 2020. The world has changed. And so for the future of work, we have compressed what was a gradual move to digitization and people being able to work decentralized and work remotely, which was happening already, but was happening at a gradual pace in some sectors faster than others. We've compressed that now into just a month. And some are still obviously trying to play catch up and try and figure out what it means. But one should look at the future of manufacturing to be wherever possible. It's done in a decentralized fashion, more at the local level versus global supply chains, wherever possible, more automation. Unfortunately, you know, at the very time when we want people to start going back to work and we have these challenges of unemployment, one would expect that investors are probably looking at trying to do as much automation as possible with the factories, because whether it's COVID-19 or something else, anything that disrupts your human workers disrupts the factory, and it just then becomes a large fixed asset that's not bringing in value. And so we would see more of that, the use of AI and computer vision in both the manufacturing process, but also the quality control. So you can have all the quality control that you would have if you did a centralized production, but now the computer vision and the AI can look at what either the machine or the person is doing and say, that looks like that's something consistent with the right steps to ensure quality, or it looks different. And so, of course, that also leads to the question, what's the future of accounting? Mm-hmm. I think accounting is going to recognize that as other fields rush to automation as a result of COVID-19 and everything we talked about back in January at the event about the Internet of Things, and I said that might be 5 years off or 6 years off, it's probably now more like 2 to 3 years off. Mm-hmm. That what COVID-19 done is it's the great accelerator. And the world will look very different. The way we work will look different, and we're still trying to sort that out. But part of what we've been doing here at the Atlantic Council with what's called the Geotech Center, I'm the director. We just stood up right before things got crazy. But we're looking at the geopolitics of new technologies and data and its impact on societies, on sectors, and how nations and other communities work together. Right now, what you're really seeing is, unfortunately, a lack of global leadership to try and figure out what the long-term recovery looks like. And in some respects, that's human nature. I mean, it always happens in crises, but a lot of local thinking, which is, in some respects, good because everything's local and it matters local. But if you're not thinking about how you're going to make your global strategy, your local strategy part of a global strategy, you may find that while you feel like you can come back, if you're not thinking about the global picture, you're not thinking about how you address everything there, you're not going to be able to. And so I think the biggest thing that accounting can probably take away from this, we need better data now, and probably the most pristine data is probably in the accounting field, to identify where have supply chains been broken, where are supply chains still viable, where are communities in most need for whether it's health assistance, and I'm not talking about the health data, because obviously accounting wouldn't see that, but in terms of economic assistance, where are there people that are going to need some possible version of a living wage? We know, for example, that there's several communities, both in the United States but also abroad, where there is food available, but it's not distributed appropriately. Just now, just today, South Africa is talking about how there's 50% of their people today that need food, because they don't have enough food locally produced, and the borders issues are now a problem that are exacerbating some countries that don't produce enough food internally. So I think step one for the accounting field is think about how you can help rally and bring your data as part of a data for good initiative. And there are these things called data trust. And what a data trust is a way for different organizations, be they public or private or whatever, non-governmental, they can actually work together in a way that has a described trust framework, transparency, a public good initiative, and even a shelf life, you can say. After 30 days, this data is forgotten. But it's an idea that you can begin to use this data to respond to the crisis, inform the recovery, and then that's something where you can also audit it so that people can have trust that the data is only being used for that purpose as opposed to becoming a surveillance state or something like that. So that would be step one for accounting. Step two would also be thinking about what we can actually do about having more continuous awareness of where things are disrupted. And there's plenty of papers that you can find about people talking about supply chain risk or global risk in terms of being connected and things like that. But nobody really took action on them because it was seen as a low probability event that something like a pandemic would happen. And well, now the pandemic's here. And so thinking about how you think about risk management now and how accounting can play in that field. And then third, really about how everything that accounting does needs to be focused on informing an actual science of resilience, a science of recovery. And I say this with deep affection to all my friends that are economists. A lot of economics, with the exception of behavioral economics and experiment economics, was based on normative beliefs as to how completely rational behavior should behave. Mm-hmm. And what we're discovering is that the correlation between what economics predicts and how people actually behave, in some cases, can be 30% or less, which is not a great explanatory value or predictive value.
Right.
But now with the Internet of Things and what accounting can do is we can actually develop a science that can inform how to be more resilient and ideally make sure when we do get back to a new normal, we're actually stronger as societies and better prepared as societies than we were before 2020.
So, and that's all great, and I'm trying to figure out how, like, what role accounting and finance professionals will play in all that, given the fact that, I mean, we're hearing from a lot of our members that just as, you know, so many other businesses, like their clients, are struggling right now, accounting and finance professionals are struggling as well. I mean, they're doing everything they can to keep their head above water in this time. So how can, in a time when they're feeling that type of pain, just like everybody else, how can they kind of take a leadership role, the leadership role that they should be taking as trusted, you know, business advisors, and helping lead their clients out of all this chaos when they're dealing with it themselves?
Right. You're absolutely right. The ship is on fire. So how do we expect the ship to sail if the ship is on fire? So here's what I would say is by themselves, accounting may not be able to address the fact that the ship is on fire because the ships are on fire.
Right.
But if they can pull together as networked actors and come up with something that they can all share to each of their different clients in different sectors about, here's how we rebuild the economy. And so, you know, none of them are going to have enough bandwidth and enough time, and not to mention, none of us are going to have enough of the expertise to come up with the grand strategy for how we rebuild the world. But I think across the accounting profession, and with each of us putting in time or resources where we can come up with a strategy that probably might be better than something that actually world leaders, whether they're public or private sector by themselves, could do, because it's actually informed by what accounting professionals and finance professionals are seeing on the front line. And I think COVID-19 might be one of those eras in which in the past, and recognize we always view history with rose-colored glasses, but you know, we thought World War II, we got through it through great world leaders. World War II, we got through it with great leaders. This is different. And this one is such an evolving and changing crisis. Plus, now we live in a world in which, you know, still it's only 52% of the planet, but that's still a lot of people. That's more than 3.6 billion people have access to the internet. A subset of them have access to smartphones. A larger number have access to at least some type of cell phone. And so we are hyper-connected. The way we will get through this is not waiting for someone else to solve this. Mm-hmm. The way we will get through this is recognizing we are the cavalry, and accounting needs to come together and think about how new technologies like the Internet of Things, which can get you better quality data, like data trust and ways of doing encryption on data so that you can actually process the data without necessarily having to know everything about the data so you can handle it in a trustworthy fashion. Thinking about how we use algorithms combined with the Internet of Things so that there's things that free the analyst or the advisor up so they can focus on things higher up the value chain, more about strategic decisions and let the algorithm help with the crunching the numbers and things like that. Think about immutable audits. These are all different ways of using new technologies and data to think about how we get out of this crisis. But and you're absolutely right. Short version is no one person's going to do it. You need a network sector set of accounting and finance professionals to identify the North Star for what should we be aiming for to make sure the world in 2025 is in a better state than we currently are in.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to get to the Internet of Things here in just a second. I do have a couple of other questions related to the crisis that we're going through right now. And one that I'm really interested in is you had mentioned as we were setting up for this interview that you had just had some conversations about this issue of how we do go back to work, how the world kind of returns to the world of work after this crisis. And that's certainly like top of mind with everybody. I mean, from the highest levels, you know, at the national level, right down to our members in Maryland and at a state level, how do we actually approach this? And, you know, we've been kind of struggling with that and coming up with some strategies that we think might help our members. But I'm curious what you've been hearing that you think is good guidance as we try to tackle this problem that is going to be coming up in the near term, in the not too distant future.
Right. Yes. So it's a very timely question. So we did have a lively discussion, and I'll make sure to share the link so folks can watch it. I highly recommend it. I felt like it was we packed an hour's worth of conversation with probably about 4 hours worth of material, yet it felt like only 15 minutes had passed when we were done. And so it was one of those really ultra concentrated sessions. But the big takeaway that we took from it is first, governors as well as other leaders in the private sector should probably first let people know the future of work is changed. And so getting back to work, it's not going to look like what it looked like in 2019.
Right.
That said, we need some way of at least having confidence that when people go into some way of working that's not working remotely or working from home or working where there's nobody else around, that you're not putting other people at risk. And so there are efforts underway to actually create the equivalent of a digital, I'm not going to use the word passport, but that's not the right word, some way of digitally credentialing and you selectively choosing when and what you share with people. So you don't obviously want to share with them your entire health record. You don't even want to share with them necessarily your entire vaccination record or whatever tests you've had done. But you want to at least say, yes, I am green when it comes to whether or not I have, if it turns out that a certain set of antibodies are sufficient to at least reduce the risk of you infecting others, then you want to be able to share that information. Now here's the downside. While these efforts are underway to allow people to have some way of presenting that they're not putting other people at risk, just this weekend as well, what we have discovered in the last 2 days, and again, this is a crisis. We may know more a week from now or 2 weeks from now, and we probably will. It looks increasingly that COVID-19 is something that people can get a second time. And so getting it once is not like you won't get it again. The good news is it's probably a milder case. Mm-hmm. The bad news is you may not present fully. And so you may be a silent spreader, which is actually more of a risk for people if you get it a second time. Mm-hmm. And so we need better data at the moment before people can go back to work. And I think this is going to be, at least for the next 3 to 4 weeks, the absence of good data is going to limit people going back to work. Because we're still understanding exactly, we obviously know it's a virus, but we need to know there are efforts to understand how long does it last on other environmental surfaces. So you may not necessarily be around anybody else, but if somebody was there 30 minutes ago, are you at risk if you're near that surface or something like that? And so until we address the data question, getting people back to work will be really hard, which to me suggests that we really do need to start thinking about COVID-19 as being something that's about 2021, 2022, and possibly longer, that this is not going to be over in 30 days. Which is unfortunate. Now, That said, we do need also data, and we need, and this is where accounting and finance can play a role, there may be certain parts of the country, there may be certain parts of the world that can come back faster than others. Right now, as of late April, both New York and New Jersey are where the significant majority of cases in the United States are happening. That's not to say they're not happening elsewhere, and they clearly are helping out elsewhere, and that's of concern as well. But we may be discovering that a one-size-fits-all for the country might not be the best strategy. But again, the absence of good data understanding even about second infections or how it's spread or how long it's on environmental surfaces puts everybody at risk. And what you really want is something that's more of a continuous audit as opposed to a one-time deal. Because again, as we discover more about this, the virus may mutate, the dynamics may change. We don't want to simply make a decision and say everything's good and then discover a month from now that we should have picked up 2 weeks into people returning that we needed to change trajectory or change the pivot. So I think this is going to be, it's going to be months, if not years in the making, and it's going to require more approaches with the public, both encouraging the shared data where they can and are willing, with also still respecting their privacy, but also having a conversation with leaders saying, this is going to need to be something that is continuously reviewed as opposed to just a single, everything's good now or not.
Is that, how confident are you that we'll, you know, have access to that data, that we'll share it in a way that is beneficial to all? That I keep kind of going back, and I definitely don't want to get, you know, political in any way, shape, or form in this conversation. But, you know, walking into this crisis, we were certainly at a highly divisive point in time, at least in our country, and certainly others as well. How optimistic are you that this crisis will maybe change our mindset and help us think a little bit more globally work together rather than in opposition to one another?
Right. Well, so you're absolutely right. We were going into a very polarized time even before the crisis. Now with the crisis, things have gotten even more polarized. You also have the challenges of misinformation, disinformation surrounding this as well, creating echo chambers for everybody. So these are hard times. That said, we've been here before. 1890s. In the 1890s, we had the challenges of yellow journalism. And that was Pulitzer and others had the challenge of selling newspapers. And so their solution was to have fairly emotional headlines that when you actually like read deeper in the article were either not matching what was reported or it was actually fairly factless. Yeah. And that they had to sell papers, and so that was their solution. And as we moved later on to papers that had subscriptions, misinformation sort of subsided because at least journalists had recurring revenue. And what the internet has unfortunately done is it's at least in a for-profit news sector made it hard for subscriptions to exist because people don't sign up for online newspapers the same way they did for printed newspapers. And so don't be surprised if short articles that are extremely slanted and are playing to an existing audience and maybe missing on facts get much more clicks than something that's well-researched and nuanced and right. tries to be nonpartisan. But we've been there before, 1890s. Same thing, actually, the United States at the beginning of the 1900s was very isolationist. And actually, mercantilism was on the rise, as was protectionism. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean things can't change. Precisely why I am at the Atlantic Council and why I chose to help create and start the Geotech Center, focusing on how new technologies and data are changing our world, is exactly that. I worry that if we're not careful, 5 to 10 years from now, we'll have discovered that open societies will have pulled themselves apart. Meanwhile, autocracies will have outperformed because they don't have to worry about trying to build consensus. They don't have to worry about equities. It's just basically, this is what we're going to do. If you don't like it, you get imprisoned. And if you don't like it even more, you may get killed, which is not good. So COVID-19 only makes that challenge even more because up until COVID-19, at least from the 1960s onwards, all the data showed that you were still better off in an open society than you were in an autocratic society when it came to pandemic response.
Yep.
Now, it's up for grabs. And so I think This does point to, though, that it's going to take all of us, that we cannot count on some mysterious horseman from somewhere else to come ride and save our day. It's going to take industry. It's going to take government. It's going to take the members of the public to rethink how we get through this together, because we're thinking about not just ourselves and our communities, but also thinking about our children. And if we don't have children, our nieces and nephews, thinking about the future.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, we're all facing a lot of challenges right now. What kind of opportunities do you think a crisis like this offers to, you know, the future-focused folks among us?
Yeah. So in 2017, the United Kingdom, UK government, produced a report on this idea of data trust. So they said, you know, we can't do what China is doing with its 1.4 billion people, where basically China says, all your data belongs to us. End of discussion. If we're going to remain true to the Western civilization ideal. But what we can do with data trust is either give you as an individual or give organizations a way to share data towards a public good in which there is a publicly stated intention, there is transparency about what's being done, there is a trust framework in place. They may very well be board members that are coming from the public itself, including the communities affected. So in terms of just gender representation, racial representation, economic status, that they're part of the conversation. And that everybody on there has put aside conflicts of interest. Part of the trouble with letting this be led just by a company or even an industry coalition is industry exists to make a profit. And so if you put industry by itself in charge of a data trust, that might get ethically blurred. But if you create a nonprofit data trust that is transparent, has members of the public as well as industry and government participating, this could be an interesting way of getting better quality data, whether it's for health purposes or for financial purposes in terms of rebuilding or whatever. And that was 2017. And it got a lot of praise as this is great, but it never really got any funding to go make it happen. Mm-hmm. Now it's COVID-19 and we need data trust. So it's interesting. In the last, we did an event last week on it, and I'll share the link with you in case your listeners want to hear it and see what we did. We did an event, but separately in no less than three other conversations, two of which were with large companies, one of which was with a government representative. They also brought up the words data trust. And so I would watch the data trust space with interest. Ideally, people come together and say, yes, I'm not going to go it alone. I'm not going to be a big company and just keep the data to myself. We need something that helps renew trust in the public. And like you said, we're coming out of a period in which trust is already low to begin with. And if we aren't careful about that, open societies will pull themselves apart even further, and that'll just make COVID-19 worse. So I'm excited about that. The other thing is, at least we're talking about developing apps that still respect your privacy. I personally am not a big fan of the current solutions that are out there for what's called contact tracing, mainly because of the science with contact tracing. So I used to do bioterrorism preparedness response, responded to 9/11 and anthrax and SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome. Mm-hmm. And usually contact tracing was if it was 15,000 or less cases. And so I worry when we go in an era in which we're now talking about 3 billion or some subset thereof people, that contact tracing just doesn't really work at that scale, especially with COVID-19, where there's a long incubation period and we have false positives and false negatives. So while I think people are well-intended, I hope, I'm not necessarily sure this is the right application of privacy-protecting technologies to gather data, but at least we're talking about it. And there may be other things we can do in terms of when is it safe to go back to work? Because that makes sense when you finally have flattened the curve, you've gotten the number of cases down to a much more manageable level. You may want to have something that says, is it safe for me to be in my workplace, and have that be something that's a continuous update that lets you know and says, yes, it is. But then let's say we discover that the coronavirus that we're dealing with right now, let's say, and we don't know for sure, but let's say we find out it's heat resistant, it's not heat resistant. So if it's not heat resistant, then the summer months, it might be okay to go back to work and interact with people in a group setting. But it may be that as we go back to winter, if it's going to come back in a resurgent, much like we see in flu, and we don't know if it will or not, then there may need to be something that says, get ready for another disruption come October or November, where you have to go back to the social distancing we're in now. And so that's something where a combination of providing information to people via their phones, via email, or other things like that as well, plus making sure it's data informed. Those are things that give me optimism in terms of how we'll get through this.
So it's really kind of seems like this crisis has kind of shined a light on the future potential of a lot of these new technologies like Internet of Things or 5G or AI. What does that potential look like to you, you know, in the face of this crisis?
Right. You're right, actually. And somebody just said, this was a different conversation we had just an hour ago. We finally found a use for blockchain.
and, we've been looking for it for years now. So
we have, and who knew? I think I'm going to give you two paths, recognizing the reality is probably somewhere in the middle, but I'm going to give you two paths, which is path one, we look at data, Internet of Things, machine learning, algorithms, even distributed ledgers like the blockchain, and they empower autocratic forms of government to provide safety for their population, but at the consequence of you may have lost freedom and choice in other areas of your life. That's path one. But their people are safe, and mm-hmm. they've got their economy back, and they've got their economy back faster than anybody else. Path number two, for those of us that still value individuals matter, individuals should be able to make choice. They should have freedom within certain limits, but they should be able to at least have some degree of freedom about their actions. We do everything that I just mentioned. We use data and AI and all these technologies, Internet of Things, and we find a way to still hold dear to those values of freedom and choice and individuals mattering. And so that's the harder path, because now you've layered a technology initiative on top of politics and disagreements and differences of opinion and human biases. But I think that's a more noble approach. Mm-hmm. And I will say that this path does not have to come out from government leaders. In fact, it probably won't, because let's face it, most government leaders don't even understand these technologies we're talking about. Right. And that's not the fault of them. It's not their job. But it's going to come about through partnerships, industry partnerships, different people on their own as positive change agents and actors saying, we need to work together on the different building blocks of a solution that still preserves freedom and choice and open societies. And that's going to be hard. And especially with no one right now serving as a rallying banner to make it happen. And it's not like we can have a big conference and get everybody together and say, let's go do this. Right. That wouldn't work. But I am in conversations with different groups, including a group called the Young Presidents Organization, which is about, I think, more than 20,000, possibly as much as 30,000 CEOs around the world, where they're actually saying, if nation states don't step up, what should we as CEOs do? I'd say the same thing for accounting and finance. If we don't see anyone showing, what can we do, not to solve everything, but to show how there is this, I'll use this phrase, there is the fabric of the economy of trust, which is part and parcel of what accounting and finance does, mm-hmm. is being torn in and being worn. If we lose that fabric of the economy of trust, as a result of COVID-19, then we probably lose what holds open societies together at that point. And we are really back to medieval ages, which I hope we aren't. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just kind of curious. How can we use these technologies, or how can these technologies help us to keep that fabric of trust embedded in everything we do?
Right. So the first is we need something that lets you see what data about you might be useful for the crisis, and then gives you a locus of choice to share it or not. You can share some or all. That hasn't happened yet, but it can. In fact, there are pragmatic initiatives that are going on in this area. But it's got to be something that is centric to you. It's not just collecting data from you, but it's allowing you to choose what data is available. Second, there does need to be some sort of continuous audit about this data to make sure it's not being misused by either companies or governments to do surveillance. And so that's a role for algorithms, that's a role for machine learning. As we have people choose to share data about whether it's health or food or rebuilding economies, then machine learning can identify what seem to be the best approaches. And they can share this across different groups. It's this idea of what's called living learning communities. Doug Engelbart who was involved with the mother of all demos and a lot of the precursor ideas that came up with the graphical user interface, computing, files, and things like that. He had the idea that technology really should help human communities come together, share what they were doing locally, and learn what might be of application globally. So it may very well be that a certain community in, I don't know, let's pick Topeka, Kansas, comes up with an interesting way to address education delivery during the COVID-19 era. Mm-hmm. And if they share that and it's discoverable by others, and it turns out that the machine's saying that, yes, these students are performing better in whatever is being delivered to them than others, that could be shared with other educators, not just in the United States, but around the world. And they can say, okay, that's something interesting. I want to incorporate with that what I'm doing, or that doesn't really fit our context, but thanks for sharing. So it said that all these technologies can really help us both think locally and respond locally, but also act globally at the same time. Because right now, I'm not seeing anyone put forward the plan for how the global recovery is going to happen. And we're not going to get that until we get better data and better groups working across sectors to put forward both proposals, but also test those proposals relative to what's happening, measuring success. And we may even discover that the future of accounting and financing is not just collecting data on the flows of currencies and funds, but also collecting data on the flows of how well are we working towards a recovery.
Well, it's interesting that you should bring up the future of accounting, because I was just about to ask, what does the future of this profession look like to you, given where we are today and how these new technologies are kind of shaping what we do and shaping that future?
Right. I'm not saying that every accounting or finance professional has to go out and do this, but I would say it's going to involve a lot more data science. Recognize you already dealt with data and you always did a lot of data analysis. This is going to involve a lot more data science and knowing the limits of what machines can and cannot tell you. And so I think that's the first part. The other good news, I think for a lot, but maybe not for everybody, is it's going to be a lot less repetitive and rote. If there were things that you did on a regular basis every day or every week or every quarter, those are things that can easily be done by a machine going forward, and they probably will, which means every day for what you're going to do is going to be different. And I think that's going to be the new normal for a lot of people during the COVID-19 era as it is. But for those that figure out a way to blend the willingness to explore coalitions and working on strategies for how we get out of this, combined with their ability to have the numbers help tell a story to decision makers, they will find that they get elevated, that accounting or finance experts get elevated up to the role of strategic decision makers for organizations, for local communities, and for global communities on how we get out of this crisis. And so I'd say expect a lot more data science, awareness of what machines can and cannot tell you, how you can use sensors and the Internet of Things to actually help collect that data and make sense of it, and then ultimately moving further up the stack to becoming strategic teller of stories grounded in the data that you have available.
And what kind of advice would you offer those of us in the profession who haven't really started down that road yet as to how we should prepare for that future? Like what can we be doing now to make sure that we're, you know, able to provide that type of advice and trust going forward?
Well, the good news is before COVID-19, there was a lot of hemming and hawing in the education sector about what was the future of education. And if anything that COVID-19 has done is answered that question, which is it's online and distributed in the story. And you know, we may tell stories of to future generations of my day, I went to classes. And I'm not saying we won't have some version of classes, but a lot of education in the future is going to be distributed. And so if you have the time, try to look for online courses. There are a lot of free ones that you can find, but you can also enroll in one if you want to as well on data science, like do data science 101. And I think I'd start with the data first, not the technology. After you do data science 101, if you're interested, dive deeper and understand, like, you know, actually do a hands-on experience where you actually train your first machine learning application so you understand what's actually involved and do it yourself. But after you do that, if you want to dive deeper into the subject or transition to how you might collect that data, so you collect that data through Internet of Things, sensors, other types of devices, or if you're interested in space, there's going to be a huge uptick in the profession that's going to make sense of data collected from space about activities happening on the Earth. And this was already happening before COVID-19, where hedge funds were actually taking satellite images of parking lots next to major stores and were using algorithms to count how many cars looked like they were there. And if you counted a lot of cars and you did that on a continuous basis, you might be able to determine that they're going to have a good quarterly report. If you don't count a lot of cars over everything, then you can guess that they're not going to have a good quarterly report, and so you short the stock. Now with COVID-19, people are going to probably be doing the same thing using images from space. You know, where is food production going to be high this year? Where is it going to be low? Where do we see signs of people returning to life? Where do we not? All these things that will inform whether or not the recovery is accelerating or being delayed. So yes, I think the good news is there's online courses for this. Start with the data first and then dive deeper if you love it, or dive into the Internet of Things or use of satellite imagery to make sense of the world.
What's kind of gotten your attention recently that you think is really interesting and has a lot of potential? I mean, and that's kind of a wide-ranging question, and I get that, but I'm just kind of curious if you've stumbled across anything recently that you think, ooh, that looks really interesting and I should pay more attention to that.
Right. So there's a company called Nanotronics, and others are doing this too, but Nanotronics has what they call AI process control. And so it's this idea, again, I mentioned a little bit earlier on about, can you use computer vision combined with AI to watch and learn what should be done in every step of a manufacturing process? So literally, there's been some efforts to make N95 masks, and it's people that are going to try and make it themselves. Imagine if we had succeeded in training a machine to know what are the steps that should be involved with producing an N95 mask, and people at home were willing to use cameras on their phone to record the activity while they were doing it. If the camera saw that you were doing it correctly and that you weren't missing a step, and literally it's watching what you're doing from different angles, then you can actually have a high degree of certainty that, yes, that mask is up to quality control. It can be used successfully in a health environment. It's not going to put someone at risk. Or if it notices you missed the step, it can even say, you missed the step, or you did something slightly wrong, here's how to fix it. Or if it was severe enough, say, you know what, appreciate the effort to make the N95 mask, but that's going to put somebody at risk because it's not up to quality. Mm-hmm. And so this is the idea of a continuous audit that is being done through computer vision, watching what's going on, and is either making recommendations on the level of quality or making recommendations on how to fix something. Now, it obviously doesn't have to be computer vision as the input. You could have numbers in terms of whether it's flows of funds or flows of other inputs, and the computer learns what's normal and what's not normal, and it can make adjustments along the way. This, to me, is the future in which, especially for accounting and finance, the machine is tipping you as a professional, something's off here, or giving you reassurances that I watched everything that happened continuously. And yes, this is on the level. And so that's going to impact the future of audits. That's going to impact the future of how do you provide assurance. It's the idea that it's going to be a continuous service that is done based on whatever data feeds are coming in. But I would really say, look at this. There's actually, again, I'll be happy to share some links with you about the video. This is very interesting technology, and it's going to allow us to not have to do things centrally. Instead, we can do things distributed, but have the computer algorithms make it look like we're doing it centrally, but in fact, we're working remotely and doing it in a distributed fashion.
It's going to be fun to watch.
It is. Well, and this was going to happen. I mean, everyone was thinking this was going to happen by 2035, 2030. It's probably going to happen by 2025 now.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, everyone predicts that this thing is, these new technologies are going to have an effect further down the road, and in fact, like you said earlier, things like COVID-19 tend to accelerate how quickly.
Very much so, for better or for worse. And so I think, you know, basically anyone who's expecting things to go back to normal, I would say it's not, buckle up. But we will get through this. It's going to be bumpy. And we are going to look back at this and we're going to say, I mean, future generations are going to say they made so much change so quickly. And it was just basically because the only way through this crisis is through it together.
David Bray, thanks so much for being here. It's been a fascinating conversation. I appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Really appreciate it.
Makes you think, doesn't it? Real fascinating conversation there with David Bray, who is the inaugural director of the new Global Geotech Center and Commission at the Atlantic Council. You can learn more by visiting atlanticcouncil.org. Also, check out the Business Learning Institute's blog. We've got a list of related articles about David's work and ideas there. That's blionline.org/blog. And finally, remember, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's future-ready learning framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. We're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning. And that's officially all I've got for you this week, gang. Have a great week. Be safe. And we'll talk to you again next week. Take care.